All right. The topic for this morning is, the title for this morning, we use only the oldest ingredients, the mitzvah of yashan grain. Now, as I've mentioned in speaking about this topic, if you drive through any of the very frum neighborhoods of Detroit, Cleveland, Brooklyn, L.A., Chicago, whatever, you will more often than not find on individually packaged items or on the entire establishment, either a bakery or a pizza store, supermarket, the like, that the notion of, or the term yashan will be advertised. Yashan means old, which is a very strange sort of way to advertise your wares. Usually when you're in the food service industry, you try to advertise only the freshest ingredients, only the freshest produce. And here we advertise only the oldest ingredients used to make this bread, to make this pizza crust, to make these cupcakes. Why? What is this all about? So there are these buzz terms that kind of float around that we view as layers on top of baseline kosher, right? There's just, this is oversimplifying everything. But it's like there's kosher, and then there's Chalav Yisrael, right? There's kosher, and then there's glatt kosher. Again, this is really, you know, oversimplifying. There's kosher, and then there's Mahadrin, and then there's Mahadrin Min Mahadrin, and then on El Al, they differentiate between, they call it kosher and special kosher, or super kosher, or something like that. And for the Israelis, they call it regular kosher, and then Mahadrin kosher. So we're sort of accustomed, as we are in the rest of Jewish law also, that there are not levels in terms of this necessarily makes you more holy or less holy, but that this is sort of baseline. This is with an added stringency. This is with an added stringency. This is with an added stringency. Now, when it comes to yashan, what's interesting is that this isn't really a stringency. This is actually baseline, probably, or perhaps. And we're going to take a look then at if it's really so basic, seemingly so basic, why is it that we frame it as being kind of an extra, right? That some places will advertise we do use yashan, and some places will advertise we don't use, or they won't advertise we don't use yashan, but won't make a point of saying that they do or they don't. How basic is it? How much is it something that we need to be aware of? And if we don't need to be aware of it, then why not? Let's go to the actual source. And what's really interesting is that the source is none other than a pasuk in the Chumash. This is an actual biblical commandment or biblical prohibition, which is pretty wild. We're really not necessarily familiar with this. So let's take a look at the first source, okay? And we'll get straight into the English. This comes from Parshas Emor. This is the 23rd chapter of Sefer Vayikra, the book of Leviticus. So verse 14, you shall not eat bread or roasted kernels or plump kernels until this very day.
Of grain.
I didn't actually copy the source, but what we're speaking about here are the five grains specifically. That's mentioned clearly in the Mishnah. The five grains are, shout them out if you know. The five grains.
Barley.
Wheat. Oats, wheat.
Corn.
Not corn.
No.
Rye.
Rye and spelt. Leave it to Isaac to spelt. Spelt. Yeah. This man knows his grains. He knows what you have to stay away from, what you can, right. Okay. Right. Does have gluten. It doesn't have gluten. Okay. So those are the five grains that we're speaking about. And we say that you may not eat bread or roasted kernels, or plump kernels, until this very day. Until you bring the offering of your God, it is an eternal decree for your generations in all your dwelling places. Just for the sake of context, let's see what day we seem to be talking about. Let's go to the next verse. You shall count for yourselves from the morrow of the rest day, from the day when you bring the omer of the waving, 7 weeks they shall be complete. What's being described in this next verse is the counting of the omer, Sfiras HaOmer. That happens from the day after the rest day. It's unusual, actually, that the terminology used in the Torah is Mimacharat HaShabbat, the day after Shabbos. It's not Shabbos. The connotation here is a rest day. It means the day after the first day of Passover. And that's when we begin counting the Omer, the day after the first day of Passover.
And that went hand in hand. It's called the counting of the Omer because of the Omer offering that was brought on that day. Putting this all together, what we have is a prohibition against eating any grain until the second day of Passover. So what does that mean? What grain? Meaning we had matzah the previous night, right? I mean, we've had matzah the entire year. What we're speaking about is new grain. New grain. So we look at the second day of Passover, the bringing of the Karban Omer, as it would have taken place in the temple. The second day of Passover now resets the clock. Now any grain that has grown this year may now be utilized, but prior to that, any grain that is of the new season may not be utilized, only until we get to that second day of Passover. So meaning once the second day of Passover comes, I can go out into the field, I can harvest, I can bake bread, I can utilize grain that's already in the silo but was already harvested and is part of the newer cycle, right? So let's say that we're now at the second day of Passover, right? This year. So the clock is going to start over. Second day of Passover now, okay. Now, after the second day of Passover, we now start planting, okay? So if we now start planting immediately after Passover, that grain that grows will be completely prohibited until the next Passover. May not be utilized until the next time that the Omer is brought. What can we use meanwhile? Anything that was already grown and harvested prior to the second day of Passover, prior to the bringing of the Omer. So the Omer becomes a very, very, very important line in the sand. Anything harvested or anything that was really grown prior to becomes permitted from that point. And anything that's only going to be grown after or sown after the second day of Passover will only become permitted at the next Omer. It's pretty wild stuff, right? This is definitely something that we're not particularly familiar with. And yet we find that this is an actual biblical prohibition. We can't eat any of that grain. So why is it something that we're not familiar with? And let me just add in that the fact that places advertise, we have Yashan, and some places don't advertise that, is an indication that this is not just one of those things that, like the OU and the Star K are taken care of on their own, and that's why we don't hear about, you know, a lot of what happens in the factory and in the industrial food industry. We don't know all the ins and outs of what takes place at a commercial bread bakery. We aren't aware. This is not one of those items. This is not something that the OU is taking care of on its own, that the Star K is taking care of on its own. So the question is, if they're not, why is it not something that we then need to be concerned with? Like, what's going on? Direct biblical prohibition. Anything that was grown, anything that will be grown after the second day of Passover, basically, this year, may not be utilized until next Passover. So what happens next, March, when we go to the store and we want to, buy a loaf of bread? How do we know that this loaf of bread is actually permitted? And it's got an OU or a Star K or a Chaf K or whatever you want. But how do we know that it's not made from grain, the new grain, this grain that comes about after that it's not from grain that was only sown and only planted after the second day of Passover? Complicated, but are we okay? Anyone need more clarification? We're okay for now? This is what we call the notion of Yashan versus Chadash. Chadash, right, means new. Yashan means old. What we say is permitted is Yashan, that which is old, that which is from before the second day of Passover. And what is prohibited is anything that is from post-second day of Passover. Chadash, new grain, is prohibited. Okay, that's the backdrop. Now, what do we do today? Because there's no Omer being brought. So the second source, you can take a quick glance. Essentially, we say that even though we don't bring the Omer anymore, it's not the bringing of the actual Omer. It's actually that day. So second day of Passover. Okay, that is the Gemara Menachos. You have it there in the middle of the page. Now we get into some more information that's relevant specifically for us living here, not just in Toledo, but in the diaspora, potentially. There are many, many laws that pertain to agriculture. There are many prohibitions that pertain to agriculture, that pertain to grain. Most of them we're not really familiar with, bless you, because here we are living in America. And we know that many of these things apply only in Israel, right? Has anybody really taken note of, wait a minute, I'm not sure I can, you know, go to Monet's this year because isn't this the Shemitah year? We don't really concern ourselves with that. Shemitah, the notion of the land laying fallow for the seventh year, isn't applicable in the diaspora. It's applicable only in the land of Israel. By the way, when Shemitah hits the land of Israel, it's crazy. It's just crazy. There's a lot going on. And as you would expect, a lot of dispute, arguing what needs to be done, what can be done, how lenient can we be, what are the leniencies that we're allowed to implement, etc. The notion of taking truma, the notion of taking ma'aser, of taking off a certain portion that would otherwise go to the Kohen or otherwise go to the Levi, still needs to be done today, even without the Beit HaMikdash. It doesn't actually go to them, but essentially it gets laid to waste, unfortunately. But that's something that everyone lives and breathes in Israel. It's not something that we're acquainted with here.
There you don't are all, have to do that outside?
No, not outside of Israel. Okay. Unless it's Israeli produce.
What?
Unless it's Israeli produce.
Oh, okay.
Happened to us. We bought a bag of clementines last year, and we were so proud of Costco for carrying Israeli clementines. And then I got home and realized, whoa, wait a second. Israeli produce. Now we got to go into Chuma and Maser mode. And you actually have to take off a portion that you're not permitted to eat. It needs to be set aside. The produce is only permitted once Chuma and Maser has been taken off. Point is that there are all sorts. There are all sorts of laws that deal with agriculture that we're just not necessarily familiar with, not only because we are not completely attuned to what happens in the industrial food industry, but also because many of these laws just don't apply in the diaspora. So what we need to figure out is whether or not that's the case for chadash, new grain. May we in the diaspora utilize new grain, grain that will be planted, let's say, after the second day of Passover. That becomes a really, really relevant question for our bread, for our Entenmanns, for our pretzels, for any baked goods or any grain that we might wish to utilize, or grain products that we might wish to utilize. Okay, so if you take a look at the third source here, at the bottom of the page, we note this is the Mishnah in Orla. And the Mishnah in Orla, by the way, is another, it's another mitzvah. Orla is the produce of fruit trees in the first 3 years of its growth. Also may not be utilized. In the fourth year, that fruit is then brought to Jerusalem, or the monetary equivalent of that produce is brought to Jerusalem, needs to be eaten within the city. That money needs to be spent on food and eaten within the city. It's a major, major deal for farmers, a major deal for farmers. I mean, you're talking about, you know, farming now, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. You're talking about a lot of money. Right? Or even back in the olden days when your entire livelihood was based on whatever it was that you grew on your farm, this is your whole salary. A portion of your whole salary is still pretty significant.
Here we are.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. This is a little bit aside from that, but it's about fruit. Do Jews eat the fruit from their cemeteries?
Fruit from cemeteries?
From their cemeteries.
Meaning fruit trees growing in?
Trees growing in a cemetery.
I've never...
Would they eat the fruit from that tree?
I've never seen that happen. I mean, there's no... I don't believe
call
there's
me
any...
Call me sometime when you find out.
Yeah, okay. Call me sometime when you find the tree. When you find the tree, I'll find the answer.
Okay,
deal. Okay. So let's take a look at this Mishnah in Orla. Here's what we say, and we have a lot of italics here. We're not going to get into all of these different terms. Chadash, new grain, is biblically prohibited everywhere. Sorry, my dear residents of Toledo, Ohio. It is biblically prohibited everywhere, meaning new grain that grows on a farm in Indiana is biblically prohibited. Jews may not eat new grain. Any grain that was grown and harvested then after the second day of Passover. When does it become permitted? Only with the next second day of Passover. Okay. Orla is prohibited by halacha. That refers to halacha la Moshe Mi Sinai. These are the unwritten laws that still have biblical power. because they were given directly to Moses, despite their never being written down in the actual text of the Chumash. And Kilayim, which is a whole different category, is rabbinically prohibited in the diaspora as well. Never mind those last two for now. Totally different topics. But Chadash, new grain, biblically prohibited everywhere. Meaning, when the Torah tells us that we can't eat these things, it doesn't specify that you can't eat these things only in the land of Israel. It says that you may not eat them anywhere. Maybe. Go to the Mishnah in Kiddushin. Now this is the bottom source. Let's turn the page and see the English. Every mitzvah that is dependent upon the land applies only in the land. Meaning, all agricultural mitzvot are only applicable in the land of Israel, or only relevant in the land of Israel, or at least with Israeli produce. And that is, and that which is not dependent upon the land applies both in the land and outside the land. Meaning, if you have a prohibition against murder, right? So you can't murder people even in Toledo, Ohio. Theft is prohibited anywhere and everywhere. The prohibition against bacon is anywhere and everywhere. It's not relegated exclusively to the land of Israel. Agricultural mitzvot apply only in the land of Israel, with the exception of Arla and Kilayim. Okay? Again, mitzvot we're not dealing with right now. Rabbi Eliezer says Chadash as well. Rabbi Eliezer says Chadash also applies in the diaspora. It's one of the exceptions, even though it's an agricultural mitzvah. Rabbi Eliezer says that Chadash applies in the diaspora also. Now, what that means, as far as an analysis just of this one Mishnah, is that we have a dispute. Ta-da! This happens a lot. Don't get excited. We have a dispute, then, between Rabbi Eliezer and whoever the first unquoted author of that first opinion is. A dispute between the two. Rabbi Eliezer says then that Chadash, new grain, is prohibited in the diaspora also. And what we would call the Tana Kama, the first Tana, the first Mishnaic opinion expressed here, believes that Chadash only applies in the land of Israel. Now, as a general rule, when it is an unnamed first opinion, we assume that that actually represents a group of rabbis. It's a school of thought. It's not just the opinion of one individual, which means that we have a dispute here between a cohort of rabbis and Rabbi Eliezer. Who wins? The cohort. Right. Yachid verabim halacha karabim. When you have a solitary opinion and a majority opinion, or minority opinion and majority opinion, the law follows the majority opinion. Okay? Very important. Now, what that means then is that we don't follow Rabbi Eliezer. What that means is that Chadash applies only in the land of Israel, and here we can go nuts with our grain. However, what we now have basically is a dispute not within this one Mishnah that we really need to be that concerned with for halachic purposes. Our issue is that one second. So now we have this Mishnah in Arla that we just saw versus this Mishnah in Kiddushin. If you remember, you could flip back to the previous page. We said clearly, Chadash is biblically prohibited everywhere. That was one Mishnah. And then we have in this other Mishnah, in Kiddushin, where the majority opinion is that no, Chadash is relevant only in the land of Israel. Now what do we do? Now we're stuck. So what we do is, when this sort of thing happens, you will, in every single case, find that the authorities that then lived in the succeeding generations after the Mishnah, or after the Talmud, had different opinions, right? The dispute basically lingers on. Which is the primary Mishnah and which is the, I don't want to say irrelevant, but secondary Mishnah, right? Which is the one that we really follow halachically and which is the one that we don't follow halachically, okay? So one of the major, major heavy hitters when it comes to the entire landscape of who we call Rishonim, these are the scholars who lived during the medieval period, which spans great number of centuries, but essentially from the post-Talmudic era, there's sort of a sandwich generation there, but essentially the post-Talmudic era up until approximately the late 15th or early 16th century, the Rambam, Maimonides, is one of the real major players in this argument. And I quote the Rambam, although I assure you that the Rambam is not the only one. And actually, there are two other scholars who track the Rambam as well. One lived before, one lived after. One is a Sephardic, one is an Ashkenazic. One is the Rif, Rabbeinu Yitzchak Alfazi, Rabbi Yitzchak of Fez, who is a major, 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 major player as far as halachic, later halachic codification, and also the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, who was an Ashkenazic authority. Born in Ashkenaz, but then in Ashkenazic territory, later on in life, actually moved to Toledo in Spain. Yeah. Okay, so here's Maimonides, just as a sampler, okay? What is Chadash? This is the middle of the page, on page 2. What is Chadash? Any one of the 5 species of grain. It is forbidden to eat such new grain prior to the bringing of the Omer on the 16th of Nisan. It's only permitted after the second day of Pesach. In all locales and at all periods of time, be it in the land or outside the land, be it in the presence of the temple or not in the presence of the temple. This becomes a majorly important view because it is shared not only by the Rambam, by Maimonides, but also by the Rif and also by the Rush. And it becomes so important that indeed we find that the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo codifies this as being the accepted law. Take a look at the next source. The Shulchan Aruch says in Yoredeya, this is in Reish Tzadi Gimel 293, Article 2, Sif Bet. The prohibition of Chadash applies both in the land and outside the land, both to that which belongs to a Jew and that which belongs to a Gentile. By the way, another important point, we're going to come back to that. But certainly, the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, believed, as the Rambam stated, as the Rif stated, as the Rush stated, that Chadash is applicable everywhere. A farm growing wheat or barley or rye or spelt or oats in Indiana is prohibited. If that grain was grown after the second day of Passover, it won't become permitted until the next year's second day of Passover, which poses a major problem for us, because if you want to so much as go to the store and buy a box of Cheerios or a bag of rye bread, how do you know where the grain came from that was used to produce this item? Biblical prohibition, right? It means that picking up a box of Cheerios could be like picking up a box of Chazer. This is a major, major deal. What do we do about this?
Yeah. It's got a hechsher on it. Would that prove that it was...
The question is not so much...
Would that prove it was old or new grain?
No. So what we're seeking to address is, why doesn't the hechsher on the label seek to identify this? What's going on? Why doesn't anybody care about this? Right? Or if they do care about this, why doesn't it become enormously problematic? How does the OU get stamped on the box of General Mills, whatever, if they haven't attested and they haven't researched that indeed this grain is from the previous year, not from this year? Okay, let's keep going. Take a look at the next, this is the next article in the Shulchan Aruch, and as we know, the Shulchan Aruch was written by Rav Yosef Karo, which expresses the opinion for Sephardic Jewry. It sets as law for Sephardic Jewry. And we find the glosses of the Rama, of Moshe Isserles, who tacked on these glosses to the already written work of Rav Yosef Karo, indicating that sometimes Ashkenazim do something a bit differently. It's interesting, actually, because at the time that it was written, Rav Yosef Karo was already living in Israel, and the Rama was living in Krakow, Poland. So it's just interesting to think about, and whether or not this necessarily becomes an issue is, I don't know, just something interesting to think about historically. But Rav Yosef Karo understood that as far as he and his immediate community, they were stuck either way, right? They were living in the land of Israel. There's no way, really, to get out of saying that you don't need to be concerned with this notion of new grain, of Chadash, when you're living in the land of Israel. For the Rama, for Rav Moshe Isserles, living in Krakow, if there was any wiggle room, it was really, really important to exploit that, right? And you do find those kinds of things sometimes, and it almost comes through in the language of the Rama, of Rav Moshe Isserles, as we'll see. So the Rama actually says, nevertheless, ordinary grain is permitted after Pesach on the strength of a double doubt. This is interesting. A double doubt is what we call in halachic or Talmudic terminology, it is referred to as a svek sveka. One doubt, and then even after you potentially may resolve the first doubt, there may yet be another doubt. So if we don't really know if something is necessarily treif, even if we were to resolve that yes, it is absolutely treif, according to that one doubt, there's still yet another doubt. I'll give you an example, just something that I came across very recently. If we find that a if we find that there was a bushel of grain that was left out in the field after it was harvested, and we intend on using that grain to produce flour to bake matzahs with, and then it rained, or it drizzled, and we see that, and then we come back to the field, you know, a short time later, and it's hard to really tell how much of the bushel necessarily got soaked. What happens if a bushel of grain gets soaked thoroughly? Can you still use it for matzah? No. That is grain that then came into contact with water, and that's chametz. So if we can't necessarily ascertain how much of the bushel got grain, then the logic works as follows. We don't really know. We know that it got to the outside of the bushel, right? That was exposed, the actual surface. And we know that, you know, wherever the rain sort of pooled around the bottom of the bushel, we know that that's all chametz. We don't know whether or not the rain ever actually got inside to the middle, to the center of the bushel. Even if it did, even if we can resolve that first suffix, that first doubt, even if we can ascertain that, yeah, it did get into the middle of the bushel, we don't know that it was there, that the rain or the wetness lingered for long enough to actually ferment the grains. Therefore, the grain in the middle of the bushel is permitted. This is a standard halachic Talmudic procedure, whereby we say that if something is so doubtful that it's not only one doubt that we concern ourselves with, but even were that doubt to be resolved, we would have another doubt waiting in the wings, then we don't assume that it's prohibited. There are only so many assumptions that we make. We're only so careful when it comes to putting a stamp of disapproval on a food item or a scenario or a case, etc.
Is there a time limit as to how long it takes water to ferment the grain before we know what...
Generally speaking, we say 18 minutes, right?
18 minutes.
The amount of time that it takes for something to become chametz, right? Okay, so what is the issue? So the Rama says, first of all, it's unknown if it's from this year or last year. Any grain that we find on the market, we don't really know when it was grown. There's really no way for us to know when it was grown. It might be from this year. It might be from last year. Who knows? And even if you say that it is from this year, even if it was harvested this year, still it may already have taken root prior to the bringing of the Omer. Meaning it's not just a matter of harvest, it's a matter of when it actually took root in the ground. So it may have been harvested this year, it may have been harvested last year, and even if it was harvested this year, it may still technically be old grain because it would have taken root perhaps prior to the second day of Passover. It's a little bit complicated, it's a little bit convoluted. There are those who took issue with the presentation of this double doubt, suggesting that it's not really a double doubt. What we're really trying to address is, when did this stuff take root? Is it this year or last year? And you can't really split hairs. You can't really divide that one doubt into two different doubts the way that the Rama does, possibly. Anyway, that's a point of more significant analysis that I don't really want to get into right now. But at any rate, what is conveyed here certainly is the Rama's opinion that if you were to walk into a bakery, you basically have a right to assume that whatever you pull off the shelf is probably from last year. Probably from last year. That's a significant enough possibility that we can rely upon it. Let's just skip down to the bottom paragraph here. He then gets into, well, what happens if we really do know, if we don't? You know what, actually, let's see the second paragraph. This does become pretty important. He says, regarding grain which was certainly sowed after Pesach, we know for a fact that it's chadash, we know for a fact that it's new, such as is the case in some regions where they sow oats and barley after Pesach. We know that everything here is grown after Pesach. Still, one should be strict to wait until after the time of the harvest, unless it's the case that the doors to the region are unlocked, and the bulk of the grain comes from another region in which they sow after Pesach. What the Rama suggests is that even if we know that everything in this region, everything in this state, everything in the Midwest, everything in America grows, let's say, after Pesach, still, or a portion of it might be grown after Pesach, there may be room for what we call rove, majority, which is another really important halachic principle that we rely upon often. The notion that once something gets mixed up, once something becomes a mixture, then we can say, well, if the majority is kosher, even if a minority is not kosher, it's okay. Classic example is the drop of milk in a pot of chicken soup. Right. Ah, milk and meat, throw the whole thing out. One second. So in that instance, we need more than just a simple majority. We actually need 60 times, but it's the same sort of principle. If there is enough of the kosher to outweigh the not kosher, then we view it all as one mixture that takes on the status of kosher. This is based upon actual verses from the Torah. We didn't make this stuff up. Nobody would have the chutzpah to do so. Only God has the chutzpah to make up this kind of stuff. So we rely upon what we actually find in the Torah for that whole principle of rov, of majority. Becomes another interesting point to think about here. Okay. What we find then from the Ramah, from the Ashkenazic authority, are two possibilities, two little cracks that might allow some glimmer of light in, allowing us to actually eat grain without needing to suspect or without needing to even research or resolve whether it came from the previous year or did it indeed come from this year. Some other cracks. The Aruch HaShulchan, which was written by Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein, a majorly important halachic authority in the, I believe, early 19th century, maybe earlier actually. One second. No, I believe the 19th century. And the Aruch HaShulchan had another interesting approach here. He says that the truth is, outside of the land of Israel, it's only rabbinic prohibition. He actually goes with the other, remember those two Mishnayot that we saw? One said that it's prohibited only in the land of Israel, one says it's prohibited everywhere. So the Talmud speaks about it, etc. In working through all of that material, the Aruch HaShulchan declares that it's only rabbinic prohibition. By the way, this, I have a couple minutes, just an important point. If you turn back to the first page for a second, I'll show you what much of this hinges on. The first verse, which actually is the source in the Torah for this whole notion of chadash, let's actually read it in Hebrew. V'lechem, and bread, v'kali, and roasted kernels, v'charmel, or plump kernels. Lo sochalu, you shall not eat, ad etzem hayom hazel, until that very day, meaning the second day of Passover. Ad haviyachem es karban elokeichem, until you bring the offering of your God, meaning the Karban Omer brought on the second day of Passover. Chukas olam ledaroseichem, this is an everlasting law for all future generations. Bechol moshevoseichem, in all of your dwelling places. What do we mean when we say in all of your dwelling places? That term moshav becomes very important. Some say it means wherever you live, meaning even in Toledo, which means, or Borough Park, or, Madrid, or whatever. Wherever you live, meaning even in the diaspora, this law applies. Some say no. B'chol Moshevo Seichem, when was this given? This law was actually expressed to Moshe while the Jews were still traveling through the wilderness. The notion of Moshav, often in the Torah, refers to only after the land is settled. Until the land, only the land of Israel, but until the land is settled, this doesn't apply. It will apply only once the land is settled. So that basically we find in the Talmud are the two different approaches to that word, which then lets us know whether this is a biblical prohibition even in the United States of America. And if not, then according to the Aruch HaShulchan, indeed it is prohibited everywhere, but only rabbinically. It's only rabbinic prohibition here, which means that, yeah. Well, I was going to say that if it's only rabbinic prohibition, this gives us a little bit more, not wiggle room, but this then allows us to do a little interpretation. If God says it's prohibited, then it's prohibited, and period, end of story. If the rabbis say it's prohibited, then we start to think about why. Why did human beings say that it's prohibited? And based upon that reasoning, we might actually be able to curtail the prohibition to only applying to some areas and not others. And we'll see how this line of reasoning works. Yeah, Naomi.
So there's another technicality based on the synagogue. It says, until you bring the offering, you it's based on bringing an offering. Which, if that's not done anymore,
I mean,
we don't bring it off to the temple, then maybe it's not relevant.
So the way, so that opinion isn't, you know, when we speak about practical halacha, what the conversations that cropped up in the Talmud really become the starting point, and then we discuss based on those. So it's a fair approach, but it's not. But the approach that the Talmud takes is actually the opposite. Meaning, that we might say, wait a second, if the bringing of the offering is what permits it, then maybe grain should never be permitted ever. So we say, whoa, slow down. Nah. Because what we find in the verse is not only the bringing of the offering, but also there on that day. So we say that once the entire day has passed, it becomes permitted. What the Talmud searches for is that if we begin with the prohibition and we don't have anything to then permit that grain, then what do we do? It's a fair point. I can't tell you why that wasn't, you know, taken up by the Talmud. I can tell you that now the reason why we don't find it in any of the more contemporary authorities is because it wasn't found in the Talmud. But it's certainly a fair, you know, approach to the actual verse in theory. So here's what the Aruch HaShulchan does. He says, since it's only a rabbinic prohibition, and I won't go through this in the actual text, but you can take a quick look. He says that what were the rabbis concerned about? The rabbis were concerned that if we don't keep this in the diaspora also, they'll stop keeping it in the land of Israel. This is the argument of if we have chicken and milk, then we'll come to have actual beef and milk. The only actual prohibition in the Torah is beef and milk. But everyone treats poultry as meat. So if we start having, you know, chicken parmesan, then we'll have veal parmesan. So the idea here is that if they're not careful in the diaspora, then they also won't be careful in the land of Israel. What areas of the diaspora then would that be relevant for? Only outlying territories. Only border regions. So what he speaks about is Babylonia and Egypt. It won't apply in Europe. By the way, he didn't make that up. That is a distinction that we find in other areas of halacha, that certain laws apply not only in the land of Israel, but then also in outlying regions, but not beyond. Meaning it won't apply it'll apply in the Middle East, it won't apply in the Far East, it won't apply in the West. Yeah, Mark.
When I buy a box of matzah at Giant Eagle that was made by Manischewitz in Chicago, it says kosher for Passover. All that means is that the grain was not allowed to ferment. Is that correct?
Right.
But it could have been made of old or new grain?
Yes. So now the question is why? Okay, we're still getting to that. Why is it that OU, Chafke, whatever it is, will give their stamp of approval even if it's not necessarily old grain? We don't bother finding out. So one issue is what the Rama brought up. And what this basically is sort of stockpiling all of these possibilities for leniency. One is what the Rama brought up, that maybe it's a basic assumption that we can make about majority of grain. One is this issue that the Aruch HaShulchan brings up, which is that it's really not, as much as we speak about it as being prohibited even everywhere, it's not the case. It's only in those regions immediately outside of the land of Israel. The major one, the most prominent one, which is really what we've relied upon for centuries, is really what we're about to see now in the commentary known as the Bayit Chadash, the Bach. It is, right, no relation to Johann Sebastian. The Bach, the Bayit Chadash, the Bayit Chadash. This was a commentary written on the Arba Turim, okay, which was sort of a predecessor of the Shulchan Aruch, similar sort of style, halachic encyclopedia divided into four areas of Jewish life, Jewish living. And the Shulchan Aruch, Rav Yosef Karo, actually wrote his own commentary on that work, which then became distilled into the Shulchan Aruch. Okay? So the Bach, the Bayis Chadash, this was a very important work written by Rabbi Yoel Sirkis on the tour, the Arba Turim. This is really interesting. It is evident that it is certainly not prohibited unless owned by a Jew. Now that's something that we sort of came across briefly in the Shulchan Aruch, where the Shulchan Aruch asserted, doesn't matter who owns the grain. But the Bach says, one second, we don't really find that assumption made in the previous halachic literature. And he'll quote Maimonides. It didn't come up in Maimonides. Maimonides was explicit. In the land and outside the land, during the temple era and beyond the temple era, for all time, all places. But he doesn't say anything about ownership. Is it possible, the same way that, conceptually speaking, if there was non-Jewish owned land in the land of Israel that produces produce of any sort during Shemitah, it may be eaten? Because Shemitah only applies to Jewish owned farms. So is it possible that Chadash, this notion of new grain, is only prohibited if we're dealing with Jewish-owned farms? that will be extremely, extremely relevant. Extremely relevant, right? Because for the most part, Jews are like, you know, accountants and doctors and stuff. They're not really farmers, except in Israel. But there's, you know, but in Israel, they're better equipped to deal with these things anyway, right? It is evident that it is certainly not prohibited unless owned by a Jew. What an interesting sort of approach, as is proven likewise from the words of Maimonides. For he does not write that it is prohibited when owned by Gentiles, except in regards to Arla and Kilai HaKerem, other mitzvos, other things. Don't worry about that for now. But regarding Chadash, he wrote plainly that it is prohibited, which makes it evident that it is only prohibited if owned by a Jew. What he's saying is that Maimonides is always very clear when he says that this mitzvah applies both to Jewish and non-Jewish owned farms. And when it comes to Chadash, he doesn't say it. So the simple explanation is, if Maimonides didn't say overtly that this applies also to non-Jewish owned farms, then it should be assumed that it applies only to Jewish-owned farms. By the way, one of the reasons why this is so compelling, this particular approach of the Bach, and why this is relied more heavily upon than any of the other interpretations or any of the other halachic rulings, is because this works within Maimonides. It doesn't argue with Maimonides. It doesn't say that there are other opinions that we ought to consider more. It works within Maimonides, which makes it so brilliant and so compelling. The Aruch HaShulchan says, it doesn't really apply. It doesn't really apply everywhere. It only applies in Babylonia and Egypt. Well, Maimonides didn't say that. He said it applies everywhere, which means that the Aruch HaShulchan is butting heads with a towering figure of the medieval period, especially when it comes to actual practical halacha, practical Jewish law. The Bach works within Maimonides. He says, take a closer look. He says it applies everywhere. It applies during the time of the Beit HaMikdash, after the time of the Beit HaMikdash, but he doesn't say anything about Jewish or non-Jewish owned. And actually, now he shows, you know, his doctorate that he, the doctoral thesis that he wrote on, you know, Maimonides' entire work, where he scoured every law in which he discusses agricultural law, Jewish agricultural law, and he says, look, Maimonides, he doesn't, you know, he's not so terse as to not tell you whether it applies to Jewish or non-Jewish owned farms. Wherever it applies to non-Jewish owned farms as well, he tells you explicitly. And if he doesn't say anything about Chadash, that means that it applies only to Jewish owned farms. Many disagreed with the Bach, but what makes it compelling is that it works within Maimonides. It doesn't butt heads with Maimonides. It's not at odds with him. And he says, it's really cause for astonishment that the words of our rabbi, Rabbeinu Yaakov, who wrote the work that he's commenting on, the Arba Turim, who, by the way, was the son of the Rush, who we quoted before, the Ashkenazic authority who moved to Toledo, right? So Rabbeinu Yaakov was the son of the Rush, Rabbeinu Asher, and he speaks about what his father used to do. So he says, I don't get where Rabbeinu Yaakov is coming from, for having not paid attention to the words of his father, Rabbeinu Asher, in his halachic rulings. So what he's suggesting is that Rabbeinu Asher in his actual halachic writings and rulings spoke with a very similar language as Maimonides, that it only applies, at least in the Bach's conjecture, it only applies to Jewish-owned farms. So he says, perhaps it was because he saw that he was personally accustomed to treating Chadash of Gentiles as forbidden. Meaning maybe Rabbeinu Yaakov was sitting at home, not yet as Rabbeinu Yaakov, but meaning as maybe as Yankee, right? Little Yankala, and sitting around his father's table, he knows that his father was always careful not to eat Chadash even when it came from Gentile-owned farms. He says, that's all well and good. There are many instances of great halachic authorities, of towering Torah personalities, who would be extremely strict upon themselves, especially in regards to things like kashrut, but that doesn't mean that that becomes practical law for the masses. And that's really a very, very important point, especially when we get to Chadash and these sorts of things, that even when we find certain very impressive, you know, Torah figures who are strict upon themselves, that doesn't necessarily create baseline law. And it's important to recognize the distinction between the two. So just go down to the bottom here. And it also would seem that even if one is ascetic and is strict upon himself, he should only treat this as prohibited when he is in his own home. Very much concerned about the perception that then gets out amongst other people, is this going to become a point of contention between you and the rest of the community? Is this going to cast aspersions on some of the leaders, on some of the rabbis, the rabbinic figures? You want to be strict, they don't want to be strict, how does that then make them look? But if he joins a meal with other scholars who treat this as permitted, it would be forbidden for him to treat it as forbidden in their presence. And it goes without saying that if he is in the presence of those greater than he, etc. We won't actually take a look throughout the entire piece, but the Mishneh Berurah, right, who is our dear friend, the Mishneh Berurah was written by the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim was written by Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, but he became known as the Chafetz Chaim because of how powerful and popular and prominent that work became. He wrote this great halachic commentary on the Shulchan Aruch called the Mishneh Berurah. The Mishneh Berurah says, and you can read through it, he says basically the reason why we've always been lenient is because we don't have a whole lot of choice. Here we are, we're living in Poland, and it becomes very, very difficult for us to be able to be careful about this notion of chadash. So what we've done throughout the generations is we relied upon those lenient opinions. You get the impression, and you get this impression from many of the other halachic authorities, that it's somewhat apologetic. We'd rather not, but we sort of have to. It's important that we know that that notion exists within Jewish law and exists within Judaism, that there are times when we are lenient, when we do avail ourselves of lenient opinions, even when we'd rather not, because sometimes we really have our backs to the wall. The question that we have now is when we have greater opportunity, when we have a little bit more money, when we're able to be more involved intimately in the process, analyzing and in being around for food production, hashkacha, etc. So does that perhaps change the playing field a little bit? I think that's what we are starting to see. And it's just important that we understand both sides of the story, that there are times throughout Jewish history when we do need to rely upon lenient opinions, but it shouldn't be found as overwhelming or overly strict if we do find that the Jewish world tends to be moving in this direction. But now that we have the availability, Yashan is becoming more and more of the norm, and I would bet that at some point within the not-too-distant future, when we find the OU or the Star K or the Chaf K placed upon one of these boxes or placed upon one of these labels, it probably will also attest to the fact that, indeed, the grain is absolutely certified as being of only the oldest ingredients possible. That's a quick little sketch of this mitzvah. Yeah?
Is a Shemir
Matzah something else? Shemir Matzah.
Is that guaranteed that it comes from old grain or not? Yes or no?
I don't know. It could be, could be either way. Could be either way. Thanks, everybody. Enjoy your old, stale, soggy grain.
Isn't that Orla?
Yeah.